Sharon and I want to express our thanks again for your kindness of the invitation and your hospitality that you've exhibited so graciously and kindly to us in our stay here. The visit has been extremely enjoyable and very encouraged at the work of the Lord that's being done in this area through this congregation. May God bless you as you continue in that work. This is the last session of our discussion, and I've entitled this discussion, Into All the World. Can we get this middle light dimmed, please? I think it would help. And the subtitle is a sociocultural survey of three first century cities. And we're going to be looking at the cities of Athens, Corinth, and Ephesus. And the sequence in the book of Acts is Acts 18, 19, and 20. And these chapters are rather significant in what is going on and how things, 17, 18, 19, excuse me. And these are very significant because the character of the three towns are very, very different. And I want us to sort of get a feel for the reputation of these towns. Now, as you are well aware, towns do develop reputations of certain kinds. And Las Vegas certainly has not escaped that. And people think in terms of Las Vegas in a certain kind of way, but as all of you very well know, a lot of this town has nothing to do with the reputation that it has accrued. Same would be the case with Hollywood. There's a lot of things in Hollywood that have nothing to do with the movie industry. Or Nashville, Tennessee, in the music industry. A lot of people live there and work have nothing to do with the music. They're not there for that intent whatsoever. But still, the reputation that exists has developed because of something about the town that is sort of typical of the mindset. And while it may be the minority, it nonetheless often colors how other things in the town are unfolding. And I think this is the case with these three towns as we consider them. So the first one we consider is the city of Athens. Athens is situated on the southern area of Greece. Greece, however, consists of hundreds of islands, and we're leaving the islands alone in this consideration. But Athens has had a powerful impact. It was one of those intellectual cities of the ancient world. At one point, it was probably the premier intellectual town. By the time Paul gets there, it's faded in its glory relative to that intellectual prowess. However, it still had a lot of weight and freight associated with it. If we were to put it in sort of modern kind of terms, they would be the Harvard of the ancient world as opposed to the Oxford University of the ancient world. Most people would consider Oxford University to be sort of the premier educational institute of the world, and certainly a case can be made of that. Harvard, though, you know, not quite to that level, but nonetheless still an influential educational institution. I said Harvard, not Harding, in case anybody's listening. But anyway, Athens had this reputation, and certainly in its past it had contributed very powerfully to the philosophical, mathematical ideas that generated out of the area of Greece. Athens was the go-to town for all of this. And certainly Paul is going to encounter elements of this in his discussion. Now, as the frame of reference, I want us to consider the statement in Acts chapter 17 where Paul has arrived in the city of Athens. He's waiting for his friends to arrive, but he's not going to waste time. He's going to take advantage of the opportunity and strategically place himself in sort of what we would call high traffic areas so that he increases the exposure of what he's doing so that he can reach out and teach the gospel to others who need to learn the message of the Lord's will. And the agora in Athens is the ideal place to do this. Now, there are actually two agoras in the city of Athens. One is the old traditional agora, which you're looking at on the slide here. And the other was the newer Roman commercial agora. Now, a lot of scholars love to argue about everything. You know, it's sort of like the Beatles song, I say yes, you say no, I say stop, you say go. You say anybody says anything, there's going to be an argument that goes on around it. And it's really interesting to hear the scholars' argument. Well, was it to the old traditional agora that Paul went, or was it to the newer commercial agora that Paul went? And I'm sitting there scratching my head, who cares? I mean, Paul probably would be going in both of them as he's wanting to expose the gospel to these people and help them learn the message of Jesus. But as we look at this picture, I'm standing on the Acropolis, looking down on the old traditional agora of ancient Athens. And the green area that you see bounded with the buildings is basically the extent. The modern town has encroached into the ancient agora a bit, but to a large extent, that green area that you're looking at is the ancient agora. Now, the word agora means marketplace. But marketplace is not simply a market from the standpoint of buying and selling goods. It's also a marketplace from the standpoint of exchanging ideas. I mentioned on Friday evening about the old traditional ways in the southern cities where the people would come in from the farms on Saturday and park around the courthouse, and people would go into the different stores buying their dry goods and all this kind of stuff. And usually the men would there and stay in the courtyard area exchanging the news and telling the gossip and hearing the latest and greatest, because for a lot of folks this was before telephone. Even though telephone did exist, most of them couldn't afford telephones. And so they would use this as the social arena to exchange ideas, to hear the news, to see what was going on. And to a large extent, that's the way we're to understand the agora in Athens and in basically any of the ancient towns. It was the go-to place to buy goods. It was the go-to place in order to hear the latest news and the latest ideas. And Paul is utilizing that as a framework in which to try to preach and teach the gospel. But one of the things he mentions when he's finally taken to the Areopagus, and we're going to come back to this, but he mentions, as I went through the city, I saw a lot of altars that you have to all kinds of gods. Now what I want to do a little bit here is to look at examples of some of those gods and some of those religious shrines that he would have seen. Now, to a certain extent, it's difficult sometimes to disentangle a lot of this because there's a lot of accretion that takes place over time, and many of the monuments that you see today were after the time of Paul, but many of them also were before and during the time of Paul. So I'm going to only give you some of the examples that characterize the time when Paul is there. Now we move down to the agora itself, and we're looking back up at the Acropolis. Now the Acropolis we're going to look at independently here in a moment, but the Acropolis dominates the entire area. The Greek word Acropolis means high city, and it is a place where typically people would view they're closer to God on that higher elevation than they are on a lower elevation. I won't go into all of the anthropological discussions as to why people think that necessarily, but there are some logical, reasonable kinds of lines of argument that characterize that. But also the high place, the high city, was also a location where people would retreat in time of warfare and siege. And hence, the Acropolis almost always was very well fortified. It was a place where there would be temples with their accompanying gold and silver and revenue, and so you want to protect that. But at the same time, you also want to have a location where, in time of warfare, people can retreat to that and feel at least some element of security. Now, if you look at the Acropolis and how it's laid out, it would be very difficult for an enemy to climb up the sides of that and attack over a wall to the interior of that location. Well, that's part of the strategy of building in this location. But it's also perceived as being closer to the gods, and hence there's a duality that comes into it. But we're down in the agora, the marketplace, where people would be able to see this, the Acropolis, basically from any direction. And in the Acropolis, there are various structures, in the agora, there are various structures. Here we're looking at the reconstructed stoa of Attalus in the agora. Now, this is actually built on the foundations and footings of the stoa that was built by Attalus in the 2nd century BC. And this is reconstructed by the American Classical School of Archaeology during the 1950s. But this is, and we have a lot of evidence to give us reason to know that this is basically how the structure looked. A stoa is basically a porch area. But also, it's a porch area that allows people to walk under the shade of this porch area. But usually, right next to it, there are shops and stores that people would go into in order to buy and sell and so forth. Now, they didn't have Walmarts and Targets and so forth in this part of the world, so you'd have a shop that deals with spices and a shop that deals with meats and a shop that deals with dry goods and a shop that deals with, I mean, each individual item would have its individual shop. And so you have all of these strung out and you go from shop to shop in order to get all of your goods that you need to accumulate, and then you eventually go home. But you're going to run into all kinds of people. You know, hi, Joe, how's it going? Hadn't seen you in a week or so. Anything new happening? And so this slows down the whole process, and it gives an opportunity for people to talk to one another on a more personal kind of level, not texting around like we're growing accustomed to these days. Now, here is a view inside that reconstructed stoa. Now, the weather here is not quite as harsh probably as Las Vegas. If you've ever been to San Diego, and I know most of you have been, this is weather that is very similar to San Diego. That's one reason why San Diego is referred to as a Mediterranean climate, because the climate is very similar to in San Diego to what the Mediterranean world is all about. And so if you've been to San Diego, you realize it really doesn't get generally very hot there, but nor does it get very cold. Somewhat of a low humidity, especially along the coast, but inland it's lower humidity. And if you can just be in the shade and there's a bit of a breeze blowing, you can be quite comfortable. Now, of course, this was all pre-air conditioning, so they weren't spoiled with that, you know, going into air-conditioned building and then going out, this heat wave that hits you. So we get spoiled real quickly with our conveniences. But here you have a couple of philosophers walking along the way, and it's a scene similar to this that Paul would have encountered some of the Stoic and Epicurean philosophers described within the book of Acts chapter 17. This is a platform for one of the altars that was dedicated to Zeus. The upper structure is missing. We don't know what it looked like, but this was the foundation footing of one of those in the Agora. There's also then the temple to Hephaestus that still exists. The temple to Hephaestus is a very exquisitely built structure. It was built in, they began building it in 449 BC, finished it in 444 BC, and it's nowhere near as large as the Parthenon, and it is, as far as I'm aware, the only ancient Greek temple that still has the roof on it. And that in and of itself is rather impressive. For a building that is 2,500 years old, still to have a roof on it like that is an extremely impressive achievement. They don't allow you to go up in it anymore, but my first few trips to Greece, we were able to go up inside of it. And it's not a very big building. It's probably at most the size of this entire section of the church building and the accompanying office that is down to the south. I guess that's south, that direction. That's about the size of the structure. A lot of people will get very uncomfortable as they look at this. If you look at the columns, they're made out of drums, and you can see fairly clearly that they're not all aligned real well. Well, that's because of the earthquakes that exist from time to time, and they'll shift these around, and people get very concerned that, aren't you afraid that'll fall down? This has stood for 2,500 years. Now, that doesn't mean it's going to continue to last forever, because another earthquake could come along and knock it down, but, you know, there's something to be said for the engineering that is here, for them to build these structures, and for them to stand through the centuries, literally millennia, and be still relatively intact. Even the Parthenon itself is only in its state of repair because of human negligence, nothing to do with the issue of the earthquakes and all. Hephaestus was the god of foundries and metalworking. He's known in the Roman world as Vulcan. All right, nothing to do with Star Trek, but nonetheless, I just had to do that, partly to show you I could do it anyway. But Hephaestus was the god of metalworking, and was one of the second tier of the gods of the Greeks. Now, metalworking, of course, is a very important avenue of technological advance and civilizational advance, and so they recognize the value of metalwork in the contribution of society, and that's part of what this temple to Hephaestus is all about. If you go around to the other side of the Acropolis, which you can see in the background there, there's another temple dedicated to Zeus. This one was initiated in the 6th century BC, And in the 2nd century B.C., they began replacing the old columns with these Corinthian columns, but they never finished it until the time of Hadrian in the 2nd century A.D. It took them 400 years to replace all the columns with the new Corinthian ones. But I want you to notice the size of these things. These are huge. And you can infer that by looking at the people who are standing. And these people are a lot closer to me than are those columns. So if they were actually standing up next to them, they wouldn't quite reach the height of the beginning of the platform itself. These are huge columns. And I'm not sure whether these have been reconstructed. There's one of them that is lying down. You can see off in the distance there, and it looks like a carrot that's been sliced up by some chef. And all of the little column drums are just sort of lined up in a diagonal kind of arrangement there. But again, Paul would have seen or could have seen this temple in association with the agora as he's traveling around from place to place. But we're going to go into the interior of the Acropolis itself, and we're looking at the formal entryway called the Propylaea. And the Propylaea is that forecourt and the elaborate gate system by which you get into the structure itself. And as you go in, off to the right, let me show you where this is. This building right here is the one we're going to look at first. And this is a beautiful little temple. It's been restored by the archaeologists and the cultural historians. The bright white stones are the ones that they have filled in. Otherwise, the rest of it is all original. Okay, but they dismantled it and they put it all back together and arranged it in the way it's supposed to be arranged and so forth. And this is a temple dedicated to Athena Nike, the great tennis shoe goddess of antiquity. Well, the tennis shoe folks actually latched on to Athena because she was the goddess of victory, of winged victory. And that swish signal, insignia that you see, is the modern representation of that winged aspect of the victory. And so that's why Nike has appropriated that. I don't know how many people connect it with Greek mythology, but that's where it comes from. Now, in this little temple, which is about the size of a fourth of this room, so it's not very large at all, but inside this temple there was a statue of Athena, winged victory Athena, but her wings were cut off. And one of the big questions that historians and archaeologists wonder is, why were her wings cut off? Well, people today will argue typically the reason her wings were cut off is because the wings were too big for her to have them inside the structure, and so they removed them in order to put her statue in there. Well, that sounds reasonable enough. However, there is a Roman historian by the name of Pausanias who wrote a series of tour books in the ancient world. In the 2nd century AD, so there's nothing new under the sun, and these tour books describe a lot of these sites and what all is going on and their significance. And he describes what the rationale is for the statue of Athena having no wings. The Greeks were concerned about Athena leaving their patronage and leaving them abandoned, so they put her in here and took her wings off so she couldn't fly away. Well, I'm somewhat more inclined to think they understood more why the statue was made the way it was than we do 2,000 years later. I sometimes get a little irritated with the arrogance of humanity, you know, thousands of years removed from the event, that we think we know better what happened than they did. Now, there may be occasions when we do. I'm not going to say that's it's absolutely not the case. But we at least need to give some credence to what the people in the ancient world said about their own stuff. And in this case, Pausanias is describing something that certainly is a viable explanation. While it may seem far-fetched, the fact that they're worshiping multiple gods in the fashion that they are is rather far-fetched. So this is not out of character with the viewpoint that they have of the gods of the ancient world. Paul would have been able to see this as he would be wandering around in the agora and looking up. This is now a statue of a winged version, although the wings are missing in this case, a winged version of Athena from the site of Olympus. And here is a reconstruction of what she was supposed to have looked like with her wings attached. And so this gives you some impression of what that image inside that little temple to Athena Nike would have looked like. As you go on into the Acropolis, to the left, you will see this beautiful structure that if you've ever had in college an art history class, you certainly have seen this. You probably have seen pictures of this in other locations. This is one of the most exquisite structures, I think, on the face of the earth. It is known as the Erechtheum, and it is actually a temple dedicated both to Athena and to Poseidon. Now, on the side over here is the porch of the maidens, and I'll chat about that in a moment, but technically it has nothing directly to do with the temple structure itself. It is a cenotaph of someone who died, and he had his cenotaph built right adjacent to the temple of Poseidon and Athena. But as we look at this structure, the Erechtheum, the central part is the part that is dedicated to Athena, but this part over on the far left is dedicated to Poseidon. And the background here goes back to the origins of Athens. And Athens, when it's being established and they're trying to figure out who is going to be the god that oversees the city. And there are ancient stories that will narrate this. And the discussion was that Poseidon and Athena come down as the final candidates to be chosen as to which one is going to be the matron, the matron or patron god of the city. Well, in any kind of political campaign, you let the candidates, what will you give us? And Poseidon says, I will give you salt water, and I will protect you on the seas. Well, this could be helpful because salt water can be helpful in, brining fish and olives and so forth and so on. So there is an aspect. And since Greece is surrounded by the ocean, it would be certainly helpful to have Poseidon on your side as you are sailing around. Athena then offers, I will give you the olive tree. And with the olive tree, you will be able to soothe your wounds with the oil. You'll be able to use the oil in your cooking and you're eating. You will be able to use the oil for light in your houses and as light in your religious expressions. You'll be able to use the olives as a commercial commodity for trade and exchange. You'll be able to use the wood as fuel source and as some elements of small construction and so forth. And the Athenians voted for her. So she becomes the matron deity. But then the Athenians recognize we don't want Poseidon ticked off at us too badly, so let's at least build a temple dedicated to him as well. And so here with the Erechtheion, you have that duality of the representation. The tree that you see at the bottom over here is a representation of the olive tree that Athena gave the Greek people and the Athenians in particular. And rather colorful story. The Porch of the Caryatids, or the Porch of the Maidens, is a very, very beautiful structure. It's amazing to me how modest they are. We often have this stereotypical view of the statuary of the ancient world is always lewd and so forth, but these are obviously not. The statues are holding up the roof. Only one of these is original. The others are in museums. These are reproductions in order to try to protect them from protect the originals from erosion and acid rain and all of that kind of thing. Most of them are in the British Museum. But this is a close-up of the Porch of the Caryatids and Porch of the Maidens. The dominating structure on top of the Acropolis was the Parthenon itself. Now, the word Parthenon means virgin. Parthenos, derived from the Greek word Parthenos. And Athena was one of the virgin goddesses of the ancient Greek world. And she became, of course, the matron deity of the city of Athens, and hence the name Athens, named after her. This is one of the most impressive structures from the standpoint of design that exists anywhere. If it weren't for the fact that we know who built this, I think this would probably be argued to have been built by space aliens. And the reason I say that is because we don't know how exactly the Egyptians built the pyramids, there are some who argue that the space aliens are the ones who did it. You might infer from that, I don't buy into that premise at all. I hope I'm not insulting anybody by my differing with you on that, but I'd be glad to chat with you about it if you want to discuss that with me. But all of the lines in the Parthenon are out of alignment by design. There are no straight lines in this structure. All of the columns on the central axis are designed to meet at a common point a mile and a half above the surface of the earth. So they're all slightly tilted inward. The columns on the outer corners are all slightly larger than the other columns in order to give a proper proportion look. Even the base of it is bowed from one end to the other so that you can put a hat on one end, go down to the other, and try to look back, and you can't see this. And it's by deliberately bowed upward. But when you stand back, you don't notice this at all. It's such an aesthetically pleasing design, even in spite of its disrepair. The disrepair is a result of the Turks storing gunpowder in the structure and the Venetians shooting a cannonball in it and hitting it and blowing up the roof and blowing out the side. So its bad state of repair is a human negligence rather than a structural flaw in the building itself. But this is an extremely elaborately built building, and we know who designed it, and we know when it was built. It was built in the second half of the 5th century B.C., and Pericles was the ruler of the city when they're under constructing, when they're building it, and it's designed in part to commemorate their victory over the Greeks, or excuse me, their victory over the Persians. They and the Persians don't get along very well at all. There's a history of all of that that continues to permeate the political climate. Inside the structure was a statue that looked something like that. Now, this actually is in a statue in Nashville, Tennessee. And this is based upon some miniature, about 3 foot high representations of Athena, and they've built this to try to show in Nashville what the statue would have looked like in Athens. I'll show you a picture of the Athens or the Nashville Parthenon here in a moment. But this thing is huge, and she's clad in this gold garment. And this is designed so that if there was a need for the gold to become part of the bullion and the wealth of the nation, then they could take it off and melt it down and turn it into coinage or whatever they need to. So there was a deliberate design that is involved here in how the structure is built. To give you some idea of how big this thing is, she is holding a statue of herself, and that statue is 6 feet tall. I mean, the thing is massive, and it would have dominated the interior of the Parthenon in Athens. And here is, of course, another perspective of the Parthenon in Athens, Greece. And if you've ever been to Nashville, Tennessee, I recommend that you take, I hope that you've been to visit the Centennial Park, but if you've ever go to Nashville, I highly recommend that you do go to Centennial Park, where they have a full-size reproduction of the Parthenon, although it's made out of concrete. It doesn't quite have the grandeur of the one in Athens, but nonetheless, it still gives you some perspective as to what the one in Athens looked like. Again, Paul would have been able to see this. Whether he actually goes on top of the Acropolis or not is not clear. Now, coming back down to the intersection with Paul, we're standing on the Acropolis itself, and there's the Agora that we were talking about, the old traditional Agora. There is the Stoa of Attalus. There is the temple to Hephaestus. And that mass of stone that you see there are the foundation footings of the Areopagus of Mars Hill. And it's probably to that structure that Paul is taken. Now, the reason I say probably is I'm not questioning the biblical account, but there were two Mars Hills at this point. One of them had, basically it was a case they'd outgrown the one Mars Hill and they'd moved to another one, but both of them are still known as Mars Hill. And so this is the earlier, older, traditional one, and it's very probable that Paul is taken to this one where he makes his defense. So imagine Paul as he talks about this altar to the unknown God that he's seen. As I pass through your city, I notice these altars, even an altar to an unknown God. And what you worship in ignorance, I want to tell you about. Now, the altar to the unknown God has never been found. And some would argue, some cynics and some scholars would argue, there wasn't one. This is just a story that's made up in the pages of the Bible. Well, there was an altar fragment from Pergamum which reads, "To gods unknown, Capito, the torchbearer." Well, that in and of itself should tell us we need to be careful about arguing that the Bible has made up something here. In addition to the fact, there is a reference by Diogenes in the 3rd century AD in which he talks about altars in Athens to an unknown god. And again, it's one of those things. I'd like to think the people in the ancient world sometimes would know more about their world than we do. I get really ticked at some of this in a lot of the academic arena. And that you have to realize that's the arena I work in. Somewhat intimidating and humiliating at the same time. But the question is, why is there an altar to an unknown god? Now, there are two tracks of interpretation here. One interpretation, which is the relatively easy one that most of us latch on to, is that the Athenians are concerned about overlooking a god, and so they simply build an altar to an unknown god in order to cover the bases. Well, that's at least a viable explanation. But actually, Diogenes has an explanation in which he explains why there's an altar to an unknown god. And he embeds it in an episode dating back to about the 6th century BC when there was a plague in the land of in the area of Athens. And they've offered sacrifices to all of the gods they can think of, and none of them are effective in getting this plague stopped. So they go to Epimenides and ask him for some guidance. And Epimenides says, okay, here's what you do. You gather up a bunch of sheep and goats, and you let them loose, and you follow them around. And wherever they lay down to rest, you kill them and offer the sacrifice there. Well, what are you going to lose? So they gather up the sheep and the goats and they let them go, and wherever all of the animals go, they sacrifice the animal at that location on the assumption that is a holy site that was otherwise unidentified. Well, they don't know the name of this god. The plague stops and they want to give honor to the god that they think has saved them from this, and rather than ignore him, they're going to build an altar to an unknown god. Well, this is a pretty viable kind of explanation that fits into the thinking of the people in the ancient world. And I'm far more inclined to think that this is the better explanation of the two to give as to why there's an altar to an unknown god. Paul, however, is going to come along and he's going to use this as a takeoff point in order to explain to them about the God of the Israelites and in particular Jesus as the Savior who has been raised from the dead. And so Paul is taken to Mars Hill. Here are the old flight of steps that go up to the top. I don't know how old the flight of steps are, but I do warn you, if you ever go there, I'd recommend that you not go up the flight of steps. There's a staircase over here that you can go that is much safer. Those steps have been walked on by so many millions of feet that it is slick as a mirror. People have fallen and hurt themselves badly on this. When I come down these steps, I sit down and sort of go down like a kid, little child dealing with a staircase for the first time. But Paul is going to go, if this is the Areopagus to which he goes, it's easy to imagine him as he's pointing out, God does not dwell in temples made with men's hands. And you can almost imagine him sort of in this grand sweep, using this as the example. Look at all these temples and shrines that you have built. God doesn't dwell in this kind of stuff. To the contrary, it is in Him that we live and move and have our being. So God inverts the tables because they're looking at, we're sustaining the gods by all these temples, but Paul's pointing out, no, it's not us sustaining Him. To the contrary, He is the one who sustains us. And then he, of course, comes to the discussion of Jesus and the resurrection and immediately gets shut down because most of them consider what he's describing as foolish. And he has very, very little audience. The Bible does indicate that there are a few individuals who subscribe to his teaching. I infer that there was at least a small church that was established there at Athens, but the Bible does not otherwise say anything about the believers in the city of Athens. So in the city of the intellect, things came to a screeching halt. Paul goes to another town. He goes to the city of Corinth, not too far away, about a day's travel in the ancient world. It's about 20 miles or so. and it would take about a day to make the trip. The character of Corinth is so radically different from that of Athens. Corinth is the Las Vegas of the ancient world. It is the place where people would go to party. And it developed a reputation. Again, I want to emphasize it's a reputation. It doesn't mean that everybody in the city is involved in the same kinds of activities. But nonetheless, there was enough of a presence that as you read the letters of 1st and 2nd Corinthians, you pick up pretty quickly on the point that this congregation's got some weird problems that they need to sort through, and Paul is addressing them. The city of Corinth it protects the passage through this isthmus. The city is over here, and you can faintly see a canal that begins on that side and passes over this isthmus. In the ancient world, the canal did not exist, but the traffic of trade would often come through here. This was an ideal strategy for passing trade from one location to another without continuing around the islands. This is the little isthmus we're talking about. So if somebody was sailing across through here and they wanted to go up into that area, rather than sail around the corner here, they would prefer to stop there and go across that isthmus and relaunch and go off to the rest of their trip. The reason is the waters out here are extremely hazardous. Very, very hazardous. Some of the greatest shipwrecks that we found from the ancient world are from around in this area. And this was a preferred strategy. This, of course, sets up a scene for worldliness. And the city develops exactly that reputation. Now, we're going to talk a bit about elements of that. This is the canal that now does exist then. There. It's finished in 1893. There were plans and discussions as early as Julius Caesar to build a canal across the isthmus in order to expedite the trade. Those were not initiated. Nero actually began to dig the canal using Jewish slaves captured from Palestine and putting them to work in digging the canal, but he stops the project for whatever reason. And it wasn't until 1893 that finally the canal is finished. But the goal was to try to take advantage of the shorter distance here, the relative safety of the traffic over the isthmus, rather than traveling around on the difficult and challenging waters of the Adriatic. In the ancient times, rather than the canal, they had this paved road known as the Diolkos, over which they would transport the goods. Now, there were two strategies that they would utilize. One strategy is they would stop the ship on one side, unload the boat, carry all the goods over to the other side to another boat, and reload another boat and launch that boat on continuing on its journey. Or they would come and bring one boat to one side and pull the entire boat out of the water, probably having unloaded it, but I'm not sure, drag the entire boat over the Diolkos and relaunch the boat on the other side. Now this should tell you something about how fearful they were about sailing around the other end of the Peloponnese. And that's exactly what is driving a good bit of this. But another component that comes into this is you have these sailors who have been at sea for all of this time and they want a party. And so Corinth becomes sort of the party town. If you're familiar with the Liddell Scott Greek-English lexicon, it is the classic dictionary of Greek language for all of the classical world. It's not just New Testament Greek, but New Testament lexicon is about yay thick, but the Liddell Scott is about like that. It's huge. And there's a word in there, Corinthiazomai. I hope you can hear the word Corinth. Corinthiazomai. And the word means to commit fornication. Now there's a fine way to describe your town. This is the way that word developed in the ancient world. So someone's going to go to Corinth to Corinthiazomai. You know, what happens in Corinth stays in Corinth, at least one hopes. This is the kind of reputation the town develops. And again, I'm not arguing that everybody in Corinth participates in this kind of activity. But obviously, if you look at the books of 1 and 2 Corinthians, particularly 1 Corinthians, there are certainly elements of that kind of harlotry and fornication that Paul addresses in a way he doesn't in any other of his letters. And there must be a reason that Corinth is the target of some of this discussion, and some of the other churches in the ancient world and in the New Testament were not targets of that discussion. Here I am standing on top of the Acropolis of Corinth, looking down on the old city below, and I was standing up there. This is the ancient city and the road that comes in from the northern harbor area. As you come in, on top of that Acropolis, there is a temple dedicated to Aphrodite, who is the goddess of love. And some of the ancient sources will say there were 1,000 temple prostitutes associated with the temple of Aphrodite, and that they would peddle their wares down in the city of Corinth. Well, again, the modern scholars will come along and they'll say, well, that can't be the case because this temple on top of the Acrocorinthus is not big enough to accommodate 1,000 temple priestesses. And I thought, where in the world have you dudes lived? You know, the prostitution does not have to be just in the temple location. They can be agents sent out, you know, and the pimps are chasing them around, peddling their wares in the streets of Corinth. I mean, you sometimes wonder what is wrong with some of the scholars and how they evaluate stuff. Now, I'm not in a position to say yes or no, but in view of the word Corinthiazomai, I'm certainly inclined to think that the people in the biblical world knew better about their world than we do. And we need to give them at least credence for that. As you enter into the city of Corinth, there is what we might refer to as the necessary room. If you don't watch this quickly, you won't catch it, but there's an example sort of how it works. Moving on. There is a temple dedicated to Apollo in the Agora area. And again, Paul would have been familiar with this. This was built in the 6th century B.C. and would have still been standing whenever Paul was doing his ministry. The Bible tells us in Acts chapter 18 that Paul connects with two individuals by the name of Priscilla and Aquila, who are tent makers. Now, I don't know where they're doing their business, but it's easy to imagine that their tent making project is in the Agora area in one of those shops. And here are the remains of one of those shops. There's the Temple of Apollo, which dominates the Agora area. There is an Agora on the north side, and there's an Agora on the south side. And we're in the south side Agora. And you can easily imagine there being a tent shop here, and Paul works with them. Now again, Paul is putting himself in a strategic location to increase the exposure of the gospel to as many people as possible. And I can easily imagine him turning this discussion as somebody comes in, I need my tent repaired, it ripped out here, and you know, strong winds and so forth. And Paul, okay, let's work on this, I'm going to repair your tent. And then he begins saying, have you considered your permanent abode after this life is over? And start turning this conversation into some spiritual kind of discussion. Paul's goal was for the gospel to be preached and for people to obey the gospel. And I easily imagine him utilizing that kind of setting. In the city of Corinth, there was what is known as the Asclepion, basically their hospital. Most people on their tours to Corinth don't go to the Asclepion. The Asclepion is where people would go to, well, it's a hospital. It's where they would go to try to be healed of their ailments and so forth. And in the excavation of the Asclepion, they found all kinds of body parts made out of clay. Now, these are actually token body parts that would be taken back after the person is healed. So if you had a problem with your arm, you would take an arm back. If you had a problem with just your hand, you would take a hand back. If you had a problem with your ear, you'd take an ear back. And you would leave these behind as expressions of thanks and appreciation for the healing of the gods. Well, as you look at this, think in terms of a passage out of 1 Corinthians, particularly chapter 12, where Paul talks about how ludicrous this isolated kind of body part association is. The eye can't say to the foot, I have no need of you, nor can the ear say to the eye, I have no need of you. All of us are put together as a whole body, And all of us need each other in order to fulfill the task. But as Paul writes this, it's very likely that he's thinking in terms of this kind of isolated body part kind of mindset that characterized a lot of the people. And Paul's pointing out the body of Christ is not like this. The body of Christ is an integrated whole where all of us are working together to a common end. And we need to think in terms of that as our strategy for dealing with one another and dealing with our relationship with God. We know that there was a synagogue at Corinth because the lintel over the synagogue was discovered, and it reads Synagogue of the Hebrews. The first part of the sinna is missing, and the ooz part is missing, but the rest of it is still visible if you can read Greek. Then there are the menorahs that we see down here that represent the Hebrew people. Paul, of course, works with the synagogue for a while and then finally finds himself at odds with the Jews and has to begin his work in another location, which is actually next door to the synagogue. But that raises a ruckus, and Paul is going to be taken before the tribunal to try to they're going to try to accuse him of charges of insurrection. But one of the discoveries in the excavation was this pavement by a fellow by the name of Erastus. And some of this is an abbreviation, but it basically comes out, Erastus, in return for his aedileship, laid the pavement at his own expense. Here you have a situation where a politician has actually followed through with his promise. He promises, if you vote me into office, then I will lay a pavement at my own expense. So they vote him into office, and he actually did it. Now, I don't know if this is the full extent of the pavement, but anyway. What's interesting is in Romans chapter 16, verse 23, I think it is, Paul will talk about a greeting to the church at Rome from Erastus, the city treasurer, sends you greeting. And most scholars would argue that this pavement of Erastus that we're looking at is associated with that same Erastus that Paul refers to in the book of Romans. Again, Paul's ministry is going to put him at odds with the Jewish authorities who try to make his life miserable. They take him to the judgment seat, the Bema, there in Athens, and he's going to be heard before Apollo. We'll get there in a second. This is a reconstruction of what the Bema would have looked like. There would have been columns standing on top of that. Those are missing, and this is the platform that is there. There's a place before that where Paul would have stood in order to make his defense. Now, as we're looking at this, Gallio. I thought Paul's not right. Gallio is the one before whom the hearing is conducted. And there's an inscription that was found at another location where the reference to Gallio occurs, which allows us to peg the chronology of Paul's stay in Corinth to 51-52 A.D. And this is one of the major pegs by which we're able to reconstruct the chronology of the New Testament. Paul, of course, spends at least 18 months at Corinth. And in spite of the challenges that we see in the books of Corinthians, I think we can with confidence say there is a viable, vibrant church there. They've got problems. There's no question about that. But Paul has been successful in getting people to hear the message of the gospel and to respond to it. And he has a love for these people of significant proportions. But of course, Paul has to go to other locations. Here's Dallas Menorus, a Corinthian delegate from years ago, when he had dark hair and no glasses and no beard. Susan, do you remember those kind of days? Actually, that trip was made when I was still a member there. Anyway, Paul then goes to Ephesus. Ephesus is narrated in Acts chapter 19. We're not going to spend near as much time at Ephesus. Ephesus is a town that was known, well, most of you are familiar with Sedona, Arizona. Okay. When I preached in Prescott, Arizona, Sedona, of course, is just down the way. And Sedona's, pardon my phraseology, is a different piece of work. Now, I haven't been there in years. I'm not sure if it still has its same character, but it was considered one of the great spiritual vortexes of Zen kind of stuff. All right. I don't know exactly how to define all of this, but it was a focal point of strange meditative kind of religion that if you got it all right there, then you were set for life and eternity and all this kind of stuff. Well, that's sort of what Ephesus was all about. And that's the reputation that Ephesus had. It was the kind of world in which magical incantations were viewed as the means by which to get along in life. Now, you remember when Paul arrives there, he begins preaching the gospel, and the Bible tells us that there are sufficient numbers of individuals who obey the gospel that they bring their books of magic and incantation and they burn them to the tune of 50,000 pieces of silver. I mean, that's a huge quantity of value that is involved that's going up in smoke. Paul's preaching has had an impact here of significant proportions. It is also the scene of a temple of huge importance. The temple of Diana, the temple of Artemis. This is the remnant and the platform area where that temple stood. This is the lone reconstructed columns that the Turks have built in order to mark the spot. I think they got jealous of the Greeks doing such a great job, and so they found a bunch of column drums and stacked them up. And it's pretty clear these don't belong to each other if you look at it. But here are some of the drums that are in the British Museum from the excavations. Sharon's standing there serving as a scale to give you some idea. But the ornateness of this, an artist's rendering of what the temple looked like is represented here. It's four times the size of the Parthenon. The Parthenon was not listed as one of the wonders of the ancient world. The Temple of Artemis was. And that ought to give us some vision of what kind of structure this was. And the people of Ephesus were extremely proud of their matron deity, Artemis. They were also involved in all of that magic kind of stuff. And Paul's preaching and teaching had a huge impact as he began his ministry here. And he stays there, according to a statement in Acts chapter 20, he stays there for 3 years. He writes a letter to the Ephesians, which may have been a circular letter that was to be distributed among various churches in Asia. But nonetheless, we have it as the letter to the Ephesians. Now, if you remember reading in the book of the Ephesians, he talks about God is above all principality and power and in heavenly places. These are allusions to that kind of Zen meditative kind of concept that people in that part of the world focused on. And Paul had a huge success, relatively speaking, in his ministry at Ephesus. It was a relatively rich town. Here's one of the roads that goes down the way as you're making the way. This is a mosaic sidewalk that would have existed during the time that Paul is there. And Paul makes such a dent in the commercial activity in bringing people to Christ that Demetrius is threatened. There's a huge impact in the building of silver shrines to Artemis. And he begins this riot in the Agora. And this is the Agora where that riot begins to unfold. And they eventually go to the theater. The Agora is there and the theater is just down the way. And for 2 hours, they holler out, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians! Great is Artemis of the Ephesians!" And it's not till the city clerk comes in and calms them down, probably finally then they have hoarse voices and they can't say, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians." And so he brings up the charge. If you have a legitimate charge, there are the courts to go to. But as far as this assembly, we are at risk of being investigated by the Roman authorities for our illicit assembly. The theater that is there can accommodate up to 25,000 people. Now, how many people were in this riot, I don't know. But nonetheless, it would be a huge number, relatively speaking, for them to feel compelled to go to the theater to carry on in that fashion. Here's another view of the theater from down below. The ruckus is over this and whatever other representations were associated with it. Most people have traveled around and you'll see, you know, the little trinkets, Statue of Liberty, a keychain kind of thing, or Eiffel Tower kind of thing. I'm not sure what the one would be associated with Las Vegas or whatever. But these are some of the little trinkets that seem to have been sold as long as people were coming to worship Artemis. But Paul's work and effort has intruded into that, and they're upset about what he has done. But what we have to recognize is how successfully Paul's ministry had panned out. Enough people had obeyed the gospel that it had a huge impact in the community. Now, what I want us to consider as we think about these three towns, all three towns are very different personalities. You have an intellectual town. You have a town that is basically a party town of the ancient world. And you have a town that is into Zen philosophy kind of stuff. Where is Paul most successful? It's not in the intellectual town. It is not in the intellectual town. It's in the town that is the party town. And in the town where they are searching for something, but they hadn't quite figured it out until Paul arrived with a message of substance. One of the things that concerns me about the Lord's people is how we often will select to whom we're going to talk about Jesus. I hate to say this, I've been guilty of this. Well, I can't talk to this person about the Lord because he or she wouldn't be interested. Who am I to make that decision for them? Who am I to make that decision? It's ironical that the places where Paul had the most success were the populations among which, according to our society, typically we would think he would have the least success. But we don't have the right to make those decisions. Our responsibility is to spread the word. Our responsibility is to preach and teach the message and let the individual be the one to choose whether to accept it or reject it. I don't know how many times I've thought, you know, someone is intelligent. If I only could get to this individual and talk to the person about the Lord, they certainly could be reasoned with. But then on my more sober moments, I realize that doesn't necessarily follow. Because the intellectual world has a tendency to think that it's got it all figured out. We don't. None of us have it all figured out. The only way we can figure it out is through the message of Jesus Christ as the way, the truth, and the life. People who mask their search for meaning in searching for fun often are more amenable to listening to the message of God because they realize there needs to be something more substantive than just this fluff. People who are pursuing the definition of life in some sort of a meditative way are at least willing to listen to other strategies because they're searching for something that has meaning. Now, that doesn't mean all of them will listen. But I dare say more of them would listen than we give them credit for. When Jesus delivers the Great Commission, it's not go to the intellectual folks. It's go into all of the world and preach the gospel to everybody. Our responsibility is to lay the word out. We are not responsible for what others do with it. We want to extend an invitation. I apologize for the length of this session, but I hope that it has been something of value to you. But we want to offer the invitation to anybody who is here this evening who needs to respond to God's invitation. Whether it is to become a child of God through your belief in Jesus, repentance of sin, confession of Jesus as the Son of God, and baptism into Christ for the remission of sins, or if it is to rededicate your life to the Lord, or if you've come in and you don't really know what we're talking about, there are individuals here who would be glad to continue the conversation. I'll be leaving tomorrow morning and would not be available, but nonetheless, I know that there are others who would be happy to continue that conversation to help you understand what the gospel is all about. But if we can help in any way, we encourage you to come while we stand and while we sing the invitation.